This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Nearly 55 million Americans live in a community with a homeowners association. And for many, it's a good experience.
Welcome to Hillcrest!
We are your co-presidents of the Hillcrest Estates Homeowners Association.
We've never lived in an association before.
Oh, you'll love it. We've got to get you on a committee right away.
But homeowners associations rub a lot of residents the wrong way.
Let me introduce to you founder of the first HOA meeting, Adolf Hitler.
My idea is this, the Homeowners Association. The HOA is not an organization that stands for weakness and nonsensical behavior, like leaving your trash cans out even one day past the limit. Or if you choose to paint your house a color of brown that is not approved by the HOA.
Hitler apparently born in Tunisia there, but you get the idea. HOA disputes are common, and many of them wind up in court. In fact, a recent case involving NASCAR driver Todd Bodine was appealed all the way to the North Carolina Supreme Court. Bodine battled his homeowners association for 4 years over the construction of a backyard pool house and a tiki hut. And the Supreme Court found in favor of the HOA and ordered Bodine to tear the thing down. Homeowners associations are supposed to be models of self-governance, an opportunity for communities to police themselves. But what happens when neighbors are charged with that responsibility? Do HOAs work to solve the problems democratically, or are they simply dictatorships at the local level? On today's show, we're going to take a look at homeowners associations and other models of neighborhood government, and we'll try to examine how they're faring in this economic downturn. We're going to take your phone calls as well. Do you serve on the board of your homeowners association? How does your HOA serve you and your community? Or not. Call us. Share the experience, 877-962-9862. Email address, sot@wunc.org. And while we're waiting for your calls, we want to introduce our first guest. Lawson Newton is a real estate attorney with Wells Jenkins Law Firm based in Winston-Salem, and he joins us from his office. Lawson, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Frank. Glad to be here.
We gave the example of NASCAR driver Todd Bodine. He loses the case. He's a wealthy guy, which seemed to have a lot of money, lost the case in the North Carolina Supreme Court. Now, how common is it for HOA disputes to end up in the Supreme Court?
It is certainly the exception as opposed to the rule, Frank. Most homeowners do not have the wherewithal, financial wherewithal, to pursue a case that far. It is certainly an expensive proposition to take any case to the Court of Appeals and then on to the Supreme Court. So most individual homeowners, and quite candidly, most homeowners associations don't have the funds available to justify going all the way to the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals prior to that to determine any outcomes on disputes that they have. So they're mostly resolved at the local level, and that's why there is somewhat, Frank, of a dearth, if you will, of cases that are reported as being taken down there. It's just a financial burden.
So it's hard to do, which would mean there's not a lot of legal precedent on how to handle these cases.
Exactly.
They get handled at the local level, so then I guess we need to figure out how that's done, and perhaps the first question is, what is a homeowners association legally? What is a requirement to become a homeowners association? How are they structured?
Well, the legislature here in North Carolina passed and put into effect in 1999 the North Carolina Planned Community Act, which basically establishes the authority for the creation of homeowners associations and sets forth some guidelines as to how they are to be structured, the rights, duties, and obligations of an owners association. Homeowners associations are nonprofit corporations, and so in most, if not all, circumstances that I'm aware of, if you buy a piece of property in a development that has a homeowners association established, it is a requirement that you as an owner be a member of the owners association. And early on in the intro to the program, Frank, I could not help but laugh at the scenarios that were put out there. Oh, gee, welcome to the association. Everybody's all friendly. And then on the other end of the spectrum, there's Adolf Hitler. And, you know, you see variations on a theme there. But in effect, if you buy in a development that has an owners association, welcome to the club. You're a member of the owners association by default, if nothing else, and by legal requirement, because you took property that has a declaration of restrictive covenants, and inside the body of those covenants it says you buy this property that's subject to these covenants, you're a member of the association, and will abide by all the rules, regulations.
So if you have to join, you're hoping that the organization is organized on some kind of democratic principles and that there's somebody looking over this to make sure that that's exactly how it goes. And I wonder if there's legislation in North Carolina that addresses this.
Well, yeah, there is, and that's a good question. You know, in as much as the association is a nonprofit corporation, there is some measure of flexibility that allows for the governance, the internal governance of the owners association. Most associations, as a matter of fact, everyone that I've ever seen, is established by the developer of the tract or the development itself, and they're governed, Frank, by a board of directors, which is, quote, duly elected by the membership. Now, characteristically, when the developer divides up, and let's just say we'll use, for example, 100 townhomes, and he says, you know, welcome to, you know, Blackacre, and here are 100 townhomes. And when you buy one of these, you become a member of the Owners Association. Well, the developer owns all 100 of those townhomes and has 100% of the votes. And a lot of times they stagger by means of the bylaws of the Owners Association. They stagger both the voting capability, the voting rights, and when the association is, quote, turned over to the owners, as it were.
Mm-hmm. Well, so that leads to the question of what the purpose of the Homeowners Association is. And for that, I want to bring in another guest, Evan McKenzie, who's been studying the phenomenon of homeowner associations since the 1980s, intrigued by the idea of utopian communities and how privatization of public services factored into that idea. In 1996, he wrote Privatopia, Homeowner Associations and the Rise of Residential Private Government. He's just published a follow-up to that called Beyond Privatopia, Rethinking Residential Private Government, and he joins us now by phone from Illinois. Evan McKenzie, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
In Privatopia, you look at the history of homeowners associations. What was their purpose, and when did the earliest ones appear in America?
The earliest homeowner associations in the U.S. appeared in the mid-1800s. Mainly for wealthy people and really nice planned subdivisions. And then they began to catch on with real estate developers in the, say, 1890 through the start of the Great Depression. So during that 30 or 40-year period, there were some large-scale developers, such as Jesse Clyde Nichols, who founded the Urban Land Institute, and others who used them a lot. And they wanted to use them to build big planned subdivisions without having to use local governments, without having to rely on a local government. So they could create private streets and even private utility lines and water services and put them under the control of a private homeowner association that, as we just heard, was controlled by the developer up until most of the units are sold. And then eventually would be taken over by the owners.
So what's the advantage of that? Why would you want? Why wouldn't you want the city to put in the lights and put in all the utilities?
Well, many developers do, of course, and would sometimes prefer that. But some of these really large scale developers did not want to deal with the requirements that local governments impose, for example, on lot sizes and setback requirements and other things. And they wanted to make, for example, make the lots smaller than the municipality would require. And have the setback requirements. In other words, the amount of the lot that's taken up by the house could be larger. So and they wanted to have narrower streets and streets that were not built as thick as public streets are. And they felt that without the interferences of local government, they could put more people on less land. They could situate people so as to have them on small lots, but with commonly owned amenities.
Well, don't planning and don't zoning.
Unlike a public park that any resident of the community can use, if you have a private park in a homeowner association, only the residents of the association can use it. So there was an exclusiveness aspect to it as well.
Well, I want to ask Lawson Newton a question about what happens here in North Carolina, and that is, don't planning and zoning ordinances govern that kind of thing, and wouldn't they overrule whatever homeowners association said about what goes on in your city or county?
Well, at the outset, any plan unit development has to be approved by the municipality, or at least the governing agency that is going to authorize the recordation of a recorded plat for that plan unit development. I think market pressure and development pressure, the increased capability of available tax revenue has probably led planning departments to say, well, yeah, we're going to allow for plan unit developments that, as Evan mentioned, have streets, for example, that are not up to state or even local code. You can see some ribbon paving, for example, what we call ribbon paving in some plan unit developments. Most of the time now, most planning boards make certain requirements that roads be built to state spec and that they be available for takeover.
I'll tell you what, we're going to take a break right now and continue our conversation about homeowners associations and your phone calls at 877-962-9862. Evan McKenzie's with me, associate professor of political science at the University of Illinois Chicago. Lawton Newton is also an attorney in Winston-Salem. Your phone calls at 877-962-9862. On the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. There are more than 300,000 homeowners associations across the country, and the majority of newly constructed homes in the U.S. are going up in communities with homeowners associations. These days, HOAs do more than pass out pool keys and host neighborhood holiday parties. Community organizations are charged with providing services like trash pickup, sewer system maintenance, and road repair, things that city and municipal governments used to be responsible for. Today we're taking a look at how neighborhoods govern themselves and how the housing market collapse is affecting both homeowners and homeowner associations across the country. My guests are Evan McKenzie, author of Beyond Privatopia, Rethinking Residential Private Government. Real estate attorney Lawson Newton is with us. Joining the conversation now is Robert H. Nelson, a professor of public policy at the University of Maryland. Robert is also the author of Private Neighborhoods and the Transformation of Local Government. Robert, welcome.
Yeah, glad to be with you.
David Swindell joins us from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte. David is the director of the PhD in Public Policy program at the University of North Carolina in Charlotte. Hello, David.
Hello.
Let me ask you a question now, David. We've been focusing on homeowner associations. We're also taking phone calls, 877-962-9862. We've been focusing on homeowner associations. But, David, are there other kinds of local government models that exist in residential communities?
Well, there's the far more volunteer-based neighborhood organization, neighborhood associations that are at least as numerous, if not more so, than the more formally established homeowner associations that are out there. The challenge that they face, though, is that there's no contractual obligation that the residents share. It's purely voluntary based, whether or not people are going to, you know, toe their contribution to the community versus the homeowner association, which actually has some kind of contractual force that can encourage people more forcefully to actually toe their portion of their contribution to the community.
Well, Robert, we've talked a bit about the privatization of services through homeowner associations. What kind of services have been taken on by HOAs that were traditionally handled by municipal governments?
Well, the HOAs are doing things, some of them have already been mentioned, like trash collection. They manage common facilities like swimming pools, tennis courts, golf courses that are sometimes also handled by municipalities. They provide security patrols. Some of them have gates to control entry, although We don't know exactly, but it's maybe 10 or 20% of all homeowners associations have gates. They can provide services. Some of them, you know, have speakers come in. They basically try to define an environment for the association that is attractive to people. They can, you know, they have educational programs in some cases. So it's actually a wide range of activities that have traditionally been the responsibility of local government. They've expanded that range somewhat, and they've tried to improve the quality of it with the flexibility that they have as private organizations.
Mm. I want to go to the phones right now. DeRay is on the line and with a question or a comment. And did I get your name right?
Yeah, Daray.
Daray.
Hi. Great, definitely a great show. I love it. It's very relevant to me right now. I just have 2 points, and one with an example of supporting the point. I just bought a townhouse less than 2 years ago. And for me, I actually believe in the idea of HOA because I think they help maintain a decent neighborhood. But I think the problem with them is they take a lot of their governance to the extreme. I just think they need to find a balance rather than be on one side. For example, my HOA right now, which has been a pain in the butt with regards to having guests, they have zero tolerance parking on the street.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's extreme. I mean, this is a street. I mean, we have 2 parking lots, but they're on one extreme side of the community.
Right. Well, let's just take that question. HOA as PIA, Evan, McKenzie, you've been studying these for a long time. That complaint, I'm sure, has risen more than once.
Yes. Well, that's true. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One is that homeowner and condominium associations are not viewed as governments, even though they do a lot of the things, as Bob was explaining, they do a lot of the things that local governments typically do, especially HOAs. They're not subject to the constitutional limitations that that apply to all governments in our society, but that do not restrict private organizations. So sometimes they do things that infringe on what people think are their basic constitutional rights, like freedom of expression, you know, putting up religious symbols and things like that. The other thing is, you know, you're being governed by your neighbors, and they don't get as much institutional support as your local government officials usually do. For all the problems that local governments may have, you know, there's usually a little higher level of professionalization and so forth. And so sometimes they get a little heavy-handed with people, and sometimes they actually don't follow the rules they're supposed to follow. They may not have the institutional support, the training and expertise that you would hope a local government officials would have. And then that often leads to some of these conflicts over matters that people feel should not be subject to anyone else's control at all. See, and then, but when you're in an association like this, you are often subject to decisions made by your neighbors about how you can use your own property, and people often really do not like that one bit.
Well, David Swindell, it's interesting because this is the nut of the problem, this question of ultimate, the ultimate in democracy and yet the ultimate in tyranny. And I know you got interested in this topic working for the mayor of Indianapolis. You were a grad student. Mayor pushed privatization of communities as part of his political agenda. But again, this would seemingly give people much more control over their lives, much more democratic control. How did they react to that?
Well, there was a great deal of enthusiasm at the time. It was a challenged neighborhood. They were frustrated with the quality of the services that the city was providing them, and they decided that they wanted to take their destiny in their own hands, so to speak. And so they worked with their city councilors to try and come up with some new alternative form of empowerment, if you will, that would allow them to undertake certain service delivery in their community that they would then control. They would have city money. So it's still taxpayer money. It was city money that would be allocated to this new governance unit that would be responsible for that geographic area within the city. And like I said, there was a lot of enthusiasm amongst the participants. The city councilors, however, ended up taking a counter view that, you know, this was their job. They were the ones who were supposed to be taking care of the neighborhoods. So it was a bit of a challenge in terms of making that transition from our representative, our concept of representative government at the local level through city councils, and trying to move closer to a more direct democracy kind of governance at the very local level.
So there you have the problem of the tension between the elected official and this local, you know, form of government. Lawson Newton, on the other side, within that form of government, you have people saying, I want to be able to do whatever I want with my property. I want my neighborhood to look good. I don't like a pink house. You can't paint your house pink. And I'm sure you run into that question all the time, this tension between my property rights and the right of me to live in a neighborhood that looks the way I want it to look.
Oh, absolutely. And the response many times is by a board of directors or an architectural review committee, which many owners associations have. You know, if you want to add to your house, if you want to paint it a certain color, it requires approval from a subcommittee appointed by a board of directors. It is always problematic, you know, in those situations where you're trying to restrain certain people's capability to do whatever they want to, and the answer from the board of directors characteristically is, look, you bought here, you should have known that. Here's the Declaration of Restrictive Covenants. We've got the right to do this and the obligation to do it. And it is it creates somewhat of a monster, to be candid.
Let's go back to the phones. Douglas is on the line from Raleigh. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, how you doing, Frank?
Real good.
My question, and I just want to let you know I love the show. Listen, every chance I get.
Bless you.
Thank you so much. But my question is not really a question, but sort of a statement of experience, I guess. I understand the need for homeowners associations because they do serve a very valuable purpose in helping to keep uniformity and architectural good taste, you know, in line in communities where they are established. But I, in looking at some things where I have had some difficulties with the homeowners association, I read the general statute here in North Carolina, and I believe that part of the problem is the fact that while the homeowners associations are giving, they're given all sorts of responsibility and power and authority through the general statute, and very little responsibility back to the community. So I think you get people, one, who like has been mentioned before, they're not well educated, and they're in the homeowners association, and maybe they're not running it as well, and you get people who maybe are a little power hungry or something, and they decide to, you know, push things in a direction that irritates folks. But then you also have folks who have, you know, gotten into real trouble and extorted money and ran off and with budgets and things like that. I do believe there needs to be a little tightening up in those areas for the general statute in North Carolina. And I'll take my response off the line.
Thanks, Douglas. I guess we can go around the table. Let me start with you, David Swindell, because I know you're also a member of a homeowners association. You're on the board in Charlotte. And maybe you can give us a sense of, you know, Douglas's idea that maybe it's the structure, that there needs to be more structure and perhaps a little more uniformity in the structure of a homeowners association before that might solve some of these problems. Douglas?
The variation, there is some variation that exists because the statute, you know, it sets the context within or the framework within which various homeowner associations will be designed. There are not very well specified responsibilities. The caller's right in regards to what the homeowner association has to respond back to the owners. But there is the other side of the coin is the responsibility, just like with citizens in general, there's a responsibility of the owners as, quote, citizens of the community to participate in, you know, go to the meetings, go to, you know, vote in the elections of these officers to the board. There is some there's buy-in in the front end. There is a buyer's responsibility to be aware of the fact that when they're signing that purchase agreement in the community, that it does come with this participation in a homeowners association, and that's part of the pricing mechanism. Now, with regards to the idea that there's this differentiation between levels of expertise, we see that in government itself. You do have many cities across the nation where people get elected to office who may not be superlatively educated or have lots of governmental experience and may accidentally break the law even though their heart's in the right place trying to do good things for their community. And the same thing is true on homeowner and neighborhood organizations where people are very motivated by good ideas on behalf of their community, but they just are simply ignorant of the law that may govern what it is that they're trying to do, and they can come across being very Hitler-esque, going back to your earlier scenario. Right.
Well, Robert Nelson, what about this? I mean, it does seem to be a great opportunity for democracy, but if it's not structured right, it certainly it has become unpopular these days. Would structure and more uniformity help?
Actually, I think it might be better to have more diversity. Part of the advantage of these homeowners associations is that as private entities, they could be tailored to meet the interests and the aesthetic preferences and so forth of all of the members. And they tend now to basically follow all of, the exact same governance model, and they have a lot of similarities in the way they enforce their internal rules. I think actually the problem that you've been talking about could be addressed by changing the way some of these associations work internally and trying to provide greater flexibility and also making changes in how the associations use outside expertise and legal counsel and property management firms. They want a form of government that gives them control, but also as has been pointed out here, they also find it difficult at times to accept, that control, especially when it's applied to themselves. But I think that, there ought to be more room for experimentation. Mm.
So particularly that would allow for more input. And, of course, that means you do have to show up at the meetings. But then when you look, Evan McKenzie, at the amount of authority now granted to these or neighborhood organizations, the Associated Press recently reported that more homeowner associations are actually foreclosing on residents who have defaulted on paying membership dues. Do they have that power? Can they do that?
Oh, yes. They've been doing that for years. And since the housing market went into a tailspin, it's gotten much, much worse as people have, if they can't pay their mortgage, you can usually figure that for several months they have not been paying their association assessments. And the association, the duty to pay your association is actually secured. The association can place a lien on your property for non-payment of assessments and then ultimately foreclose. In good times, they haven't needed to do that so much, but although it has happened many times. But in bad times, the foreclosure situation is very, very serious because many associations are not getting paid the assessments that they need to pay their operating expenses and also to put money in reserves for repair and replacement of major building components down the road. And so they have gotten much more aggressive about collecting assessments, and it causes a huge problem for many owners who don't realize how serious this obligation is. Many owners don't realize the association can foreclose on them. They think only the bank can. But the association certainly can. And these problems have led to, I think, increasing state oversight. In other words, I think you could have much more diversity in the operating rules, but I think there needs to be state oversight of some of the foreclosure practices to make sure they're following the rules and that they're not abusing the right of foreclosure, and other types of things to make sure that associations actually follow their own rules without the owner having to go file a civil suit and spend 7 years in court and go bankrupt, chasing the association. There needs to be some kind of low-cost dispute resolution and mediation procedures at the local level, but it's very hard to get, local or state governments to step up and do that now because they themselves are running short on money. So it's a real challenge right now.
Well, Lawson Newton, I'm sure you've run into that, representing both homeowners associations and clients against homeowners associations. As you said earlier, you can't afford to most people don't afford to take them to court. What are the processes, and does the state have any regulation or authority over making sure that there is a dispute resolution process and that it's been followed?
Well, one thing that I was very much in favor of, and this is something that I think Evan relayed earlier and at least referenced earlier, was I would love to see in North Carolina the capability for required either mediation or arbitration in homeowner disputes. I would also like to see the General Assembly say, you know, in these certain circumstances, if a homeowners association or the owners association brings suit, that the prevailing party is awarded their cost and attorney's fees. It would bring to a quick resolution a lot of these items where, you know, they muscle in and say, well, we got more money than the than this poor little homeowner, and we're going to squash their rights. I really do feel like, and the statute that North Carolina's General Assembly passed does set forth some requirements as with respect to the foreclosure on a lien, when you can file it. I mean, there are specific provisions in the Planned Community Act that state, here is how you can file, here are the notice requirements, here's what you have to do, and then the foreclosure process is one that is very similar to a mortgage foreclosure process. But, again, I would love to see some flexibility and some teeth put in it from a consumer standpoint of saying, you know, there's going to be some required mediation and or arbitration with respect to architectural review matters, for example.
On the State of Things today, talking about homeowner associations, neighborhood governments, my guests are Robert H. Nelson, author of Private Neighborhoods and the Transformation of Local Government, Lawson Newton's an attorney based in Winston-Salem, Evan McKenzie, author of Beyond Privatopia, Rethinking Residential Private Government, and public policy professor David Swindell. Our conversation continues with your phone calls at 877-962-9862 in a moment. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about an issue that affects nearly 55 million Americans, homeowners associations. Are HOAs a sustainable model of self-governance, and will these associations be able to survive in the aftermath of the housing market collapse? My guests are Lawson Newton, a real estate attorney with Wells Jenkins Law Firm in Winston-Salem. Evan McKenzie is the author of the new book, Beyond Privatopia. David Swindell is director of the PhD in Public Policy Program at UNC Charlotte. And Robert Nelson, author of Private Neighborhoods and the Transformation of Local Governments. Your phone calls as well, 877-962-9862. Let's get right to the phones. Marion in Chapel Hill. Hello, Marion.
Hello, and thanks for having me on the show.
Sure thing. Go ahead.
I want to relate a brief but significant experience. I bought a townhome in 2000 in Southern Village in Chapel Hill. And like many owners, I went in thinking, good, I'm going to buy a townhome. I'm not going to have to worry about, you know, maintenance and that kind of thing. Somebody else will take care of that. Well, I hadn't been there long when there was a knock at my door, and there stood a woman whom I didn't know. She introduced herself, and she said that she was a board member and that she'd been on the board for a couple of years and that she had become aware that townhome funds that were part of the general HOA at Southern Village were being misappropriated. She had tried to get somebody, other members of the board, to pay attention to it, and they didn't. And so, fearing liability, she announced she was going to resign from the board. And she handed me an envelope, and she said, "Here's all the material. And here's all my information. It's now your problem. You handle it. Welcome to the HOA."
did she bring cookies? I'm just asking.
No.
Just the folder. Okay.
Just the folder was contained in the folder were management reports from the management company that she said were inconsistent. And basically, her charge was that money from the townhome reserve fund was being just dumped into the general HOA fund.
Well, what'd you do?
Well, it was a learning experience, to say the least. Well, a few of us got involved, and we started looking into it. And we had some very good fortune in the whole dilemma. Because a CPA, and a very honorable man, was elected to the board. And we would go, we organized a townhome committee. We went to the board meetings every month, and we would just say our plea. These accounts you know, our management reports don't balance, you know.
Yeah.
And they kind of blew us off for several months. And said, of course they balance. These are balance sheets. What do you think balance sheets are?
The fact that the numbers don't add up means nothing. See what it says at the top? Balance. Great.
But eventually, the CPA who had been elected treasurer, who was the treasurer on the board, looked at it one day and he said, oh, my goodness, this balance sheet doesn't balance. Well, it's like he couldn't conceive of such a thing.
Yeah.
Well, he got into it. And with the support of the president of the board, who also said, I don't care what it takes, we're going to get this cleaned up.
Right.
But my point in all this is that we were working with this board that had a lot of integrity, and they wanted to do the job right. But even then, it took us 5 months. We had to go back through every single invoice, you know, since the inception of the homeowners association, it was an incredible amount of work.
Well, I want to leave it there, Marion, because I think it's raised a number of interesting points, and I'm sure my guests have something to say about it, but it raises a very interesting question to me, and I think one that you raise is the amount of energy that you need to put into it, which is to say, if you're going to have a system that works, it does require a certain amount of commitment. I mean, maybe you worked over and above, but maybe that's what it takes to have a good homeowners association. So thank you for raising that, and let me put a question like that to my guest. Thanks for calling, Marion. What about that? I mean, this does seem an opportunity. If this is what we want, because there's so much complaint about big government being, you know, not effective, that certainly is behind a lot of the political impetus today. Maybe this is what we don't want to do. We don't want to roll up our sleeves and do what Marion did, which is find out how things are and are not working.
Well, Frank, could I chime in here?
Yeah.
Evan,
yeah.
I understand that call very, very well. And my basic point in this new book is to say that I think the institution that we have now really places too much reliance on the resources of individual owners to make them work right. And we've got to create some mechanisms so that owners don't have to put so much time and energy in order to have a properly running association. Like, for example, if we could require public disclosure on the real estate forms and elsewhere of associations' basic facts about their finances, then maybe the market could control some of this. Because right now it's secret. You don't get to know about your association's finances until after you've made, in most cases, made an offer on a property and you have full disclosure rights. Every shopper for a house should be able to find out the finances, of basic finances, how much in reserve, what the assessments are, and so forth, these associations. And I think we've got to find some ways to give some institutional support to these members so the owners don't have to work so hard to make them run, because it's not a sustainable model if they have to work as hard as they do right now.
David Swindell?
Yeah, speaking as a member of a homeowner association board currently, I can certainly empathize that, yeah, it takes time, and you have to develop some expertise on some subject matter that you may not have had going in nor expected to have to develop when you began that volunteer role, because obviously these positions are all volunteer-based, they're not paid. So sometimes it can be a real drag to have to deal with some issues that you might think are mundane or maybe some things that are pretty advanced in terms of engineering issues or property value protection decisions that have to be made that you're not fully well versed in. And so that is a real challenge, and it goes back to a point that was made earlier with regards to the resources that are available to these boards that are many of them relying either on their own expertise, which may be limited, or relying on external developers or property management companies that they end up having to be watchdogs over, and that's a whole nother different role that they may end up having to play.
877-962-9862. Let's go out to Cary, where Andy's on the line. Hello, Andy.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm very much against homeowners associations, and the problem is it's getting very hard to find houses that don't have those. And there's a neighborhood that I'm interested in that has an association, but I think it's weakened, where they're not really telling homeowners what color they can paint their house. And what I'm worried about is if I were to buy in what I think is a safe homeowners association, could they change their authority later to where they do dictate you know, the color of your house after I've already bought into it?
Oh, that's a good question. Thank you, Andy. Anybody take that? What's the rule on that? I've looked at the bylaws. Now they change it.
Frank, if I can jump in, there are amendment provisions in just about every set of bylaws and declarations that there are out there governing homeowners associations. And furthermore, there is this nebulous creature that the caller was talking about, the color of your house is not characteristically set out in either the bylaws or certainly not in the declaration. But what is set out is those determinations are going to be made by the Architectural Review Committee in their sole discretion. Well, that's going to change, and that's the nature of the beast, and they're going to promulgate certain rules, regulations that they are authorized to do under the declaration and under their own bylaws. And yeah, so caller, your situation is such that yes, there is going to be an ebb and flow with respect to who's on that architectural review committee, who's going to be able to approve the addition to your house, what the architectural framework's got to look like. All those things are subject to change within the body of the declaration and within the body of the bylaws.
Can I also chime in on that? Because we've run into this on our own experience on our home association, that when you are trying to change these rules, though, there are usually some pretty substantial barriers to just doing that willy-nilly. Yes. I mean, you have super majorities are involved of the owners and the property. So there are different rules like that it can't just be changed because a new president comes in and has a different color palette choice. It actually does have to go through some process, and that's by statute, I believe, if I recall correctly. So there is that mechanism to protect against some of that discretion that can create some confusion and fear.
You know, there's always this complaint that one homeowner, one person on the board tends to be the president, has ruined everything. They become too authoritarian. But I'm curious to know why that's a problem and why in the next election, if that's been an issue, that person isn't overthrown and we have a new president. Aren't the rules flexible enough to change things when it becomes too authoritarian?
Well, part of the problem is here, both of those things are right. I mean, the basic rules, the basic declaration, the ground rules, so to speak, the Constitution, is usually only subject to change by supermajority vote, usually 70 or 75, sometimes two-thirds, 75% of all unit owners have to vote to change the basic rules of the declaration. And that's almost always the situation. But then there are these operating rules, parking right. rules and architectural review rules and things of this sort that actually in many cases are made by the board of directors or by an architectural review committee. So there are behavioral rules and other guidelines that might be subject to a change by a small group of people. And that sometimes does subject you to the whims of your neighbors when the board changes. But, the thing people sometimes don't realize is that if they ever read the declaration, which I think most people don't, most owners simply don't read them at all, don't even know what the rules are. They just move in and they get a copy at the closing or settlement, mm-hmm. and then they maybe stick it in a drawer someplace. What they don't realize is that you really can be subject to the decisions that your neighbors make. I mean, here in Illinois, a board on its own authority, without putting it to a vote of the members, is allowed to ban renters. They can amend their rules to ban renting of units, and they can make new rules banning pets on their own authority. What you're buying into is not just the rules you signed for, but you're also buying into a regime where your neighbors may be able to make some very important decisions about your life.
I wonder what.
And that does.
Go ahead.
That does put the burden again on the. To reinforce that earlier point, that there is a burden on the individuals, just like citizens, that they do have to participate and pay attention to this. Mm-hmm. And that's why sometimes they will get caught off guard by these changes because they're just simply unaware of them.
Yeah, and often people don't participate. That's
if you ask
almost anyone who works in this industry as a lawyer or property manager, they'll tell you that often it's very hard even to get people to serve on boards. And that's why often it falls to the same people year after year. because there's kind of a culture of non-participation develops where people just don't want to do it. It's just, you know, the work and the time and the energy. And we can say, well, we know as a fact, as a matter of fact, these are the burdens that you are taking on. I mean, this is part of this type of ownership. But it's another thing to get people to do it. That's why I think we may be over-relying on owners. They may not enough of them may be willing to do it outside of, say, the top 10% of the income distribution that lived in these type of developments many years ago.
And have the time to do it. So greater participation, exactly. And Evan, as you suggest, maybe more transparency and accountability could improve things.
I certainly think so.
I would submit to each of you that homeowners associations are a mere microcosm of our own government. Right. And when you look at all the issues that homeowners associations take a look at, they're a mirror of your own local city council. Lack of participation, no voting. Right. It's very difficult to get anybody to show up to an owners association meeting. It's very difficult to say, well, do you actually know what the budget contains? Absolutely not. And, I agree. I think maybe Evan was talking a lot earlier, or maybe one of the other folks was talking earlier. I would never consider buying any piece of property that has an owner's association without reading the declaration and without taking a look at what do you have in capital reserves, what's your budget like, what is your bank account looking like. But, those of us on this call, we're in the absolute minority. John Q. Public, doesn't have any earthly idea about that, and I would wholeheartedly implore, legislators to say, look, we're going to make this a requirement. If you got a plan unit development, you got to disclose the declaration and the bylaws, and you also have to show us what's your financial condition right now today before I put an offer.
And if you saw that, you might take it as seriously as the test scores in your local school.
Absolutely.
Which is something you
used to
consider. I've got about a minute left. Maybe I can go around the table. The future of homeowners associations, will there be more of them? Will there be less? Let me start with Robert Nelson. What do you think?
It certainly seems inevitable that there are going to be a lot more. The growth has been explosive. There have been some problems, as has been mentioned, due to the housing downturn. I mean, of course, it's affected the whole housing sector, and it's had particular implications for homeowners associations. And area that I think, that I've been encouraging people to think about is maybe we need a new bankruptcy chapter specifically for community associations, because basically the current bankruptcy laws, which are designed for private business corporations, they really don't fit the circumstances of homeowners associations at all.
Evan McKenzie, the future?
Well, a lot of them are going to be in financial trouble, and they're getting in financial trouble right now. Some of them are going to succeed, especially those with affluent, competent residents who understand what they've bought into. A lot of at the lower end of the economic spectrum in terms of homeownership, people who got in the converted apartment buildings, that sort of thing, I think a lot of these developments are going to have to be deprivatized and turned back into apartments or taken over by public redevelopment agencies.
I want to thank all of you for being on the program today. Evan McKenzie, author of Privatopia and Beyond Privatopia. David Swindell, director of the PhD in Public Policy Program at UNC Charlotte. Lawson Newton, real estate attorney with Wells Jenkins Law Firm in Winston-Salem. And Robert H. Nelson, professor of public policy at the University of Maryland, author of Private Neighborhoods and Transformation of Local Government. Thank all of you for being on the program.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.